Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a special webcast from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Today is March 22nd, and we have, for the second time, a special guest who will share his insights into the history of alternative energy technology, in particular that of turning water into combustible fuel. His name is Andrew Makrowski. We gave an introduction yesterday as to his background, which is quite extensive. He is a Canadian who has been involved in alternative energy research for over 30 years and has had personal contact with many inventors of alternative energy devices, in particular devices that decompose water into combustible hydrogen and oxygen. So we would invite Mr. Makrowski to join us, and we would look forward to picking up the story where we left off yesterday, which included information about Yul Brown, the Bulgarian immigrant to Australia who is responsible for what is known as Brown's gas technology. Let's see if Mr. Makrowski isn't with us now.
Okay, I'm here.
Great. Andrew, welcome back. This is our second interview, and let's see if today's hour-long program won't bring out the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey says.
Okay. Would you like me to start where I ended up yesterday?
Well, maybe we could just recap yesterday's show. We talked about Tesla.
Yes.
And you had remarked that you had come across a book.
Yes.
Written by Tesla or about
no,
Tesla?
No, no, no. This is by Mr. O'Neill. He was the science editor of New York Herald Tribune.
And there was
in
only
the 50s.
One copy of it in existence that you were able to find.
Yes, there's only one in all of Canada and the United States.
And you were able to see to it that it was reprinted.
Yes, right. That's the way it goes.
Is
you have
it available
to,
now from you or from other outlets? Or?
No. We just found a proper publisher. That's our water.
And so it can be purchased from Amazon or any other.
Oh, outlet. Now it's easy to obtain them. Like, you know, there's no problem. There are several sources. One just has to look for. They've been, you know, you can even probably get them in your library. Mm-hmm. So this is not an issue anymore.
Right. But it's just an example of how the history of alternative energy technology has been somewhat obscured and made difficult
well,
for the public to latch on.
Yeah, it's the trial of time, you know. The librarians throw away books. They don't, you know, they don't, may not know how important Tesla may have been. And, of course, we must not forget there have been other people who worked very hard all this time. We're now talking about the time that I was working in the 70s. Mr. Anderson, the engineer from IEEE, who tried to revive Tesla's work and to analyze each aspect of the technology. And, of course, that kind of research has led to lots of documentation, some of it relatively, like, new for the public. For example, it was possible to find out from the archives of lawyers who work with Tesla to find out all the dockets that were sent to the patent office and to see the original stuff, you know, the which was sometimes longer than what was in the patents. And, of course, you understand better Tesla's thinking. Then there were some papers that were testimonies given to the United States government officials for the Supreme Court case against Marconi to establish that Tesla, in fact, did invent radio, which, of course, was won. This was a very important case for the United States government because during the wartime, it didn't look very good. It looked like only Italians, you know, the enemy of the United States at that time, World War II, had the right to radio. But, of course, that was overturned and was demonstrated. And in those proceedings, Tesla explained exactly in great detail how the wireless transmission actually work. You know, given saying, like, if you follow my patent this and use such and such picture and you see this drawing here, this is followed by such and such, you know, patent in such and such way, et cetera, et cetera. And it gives a great detail, like he used this testimony not only type of radio, but also wireless transmission.
Of electricity.
Of electricity, yes. And, of course, I also found some dockets at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, in which it was clear that Tesla was reporting to Morgan around 1902 that he transmitted electricity without wires with only 2% loss from New York City to Los Angeles. And that's amazing. I mean, even today, first of all, you can't transmit electricity from New York City to Los Angeles, even with the grid that exists today. Secondly, you would not have 2% loss. You probably have anywhere from 30 to 50% loss.
Nice.
So, and that's without wires, no interference, and so on. No. So this is lots of digging here and there, you know.
Okay, well, we talked about Ewell Brown also.
Yes.
And you had finished by saying that we need to consider another individual who was responsible for Ewell Brown's technology coming into public view.
Yeah, this was Christopher Bird of a rather notable family in Georgetown, you know, in Washington, D.C., the Bird family. B-I-R-D, and actually originally white Russian family. And this Mr. Bird worked in many ways for U.S. government and also privately because of his own financial means, trying to use his clout in the elite of United States society, you know, all the corporate heads and so on, to introduce to one by one to the chiefs, the chairmen, the chief executive officers, chairman of the board of major United States corporation, Ewell Brown. So there was a time of several months that Ewell Brown visited every large corporation you can think of in the United States, like United States Steel, Republic Steel, General Motors, Ford, etc., and he demonstrated to each his technology, including NASA, at Cape Canaveral.
And this was during what time period?
We're talking about the early 80s.
It's around the same time that Stan Meyer began getting interested in this technology.
Yeah, but Stan Meyer has a very different technology. I'm sorry, in way of his produce.
Nevertheless, Ewell Brown may have actually inspired him.
This may not necessarily be so. One has to accept the possibility that Stan Meyer went on his own with his own principles and so on. No, that's a different. We have to. It is a creativity stream of its own.
Yes.
what I'm trying to impress to you is that. One by one, these people got these private presentations, full-blown. They would probably last several hours. They were tantalized by what Ewell Brown showed, and they did nothing.
Yeah.
The doing nothing is not the fault of the chief executive officers, but I would say it's the fault of the way corporations are created, structured, and manage in the United States. When you compare to the situation that occurred afterwards, when Ewell Brown went back to Australia, he was approached by the Chinese government consul general for Sydney, Australia, who paid for the ticket, like there was no need for, you know, to have other thing. So the government of China invites Mr. Ewell Brown, gets him delivered to the top scientists in China. In this case, this would be the in Beijing University, physics, and of course, who knew anything about hydrogen, makes a demonstration that lasts only about 1 hour. Within half an hour thereafter, the chief of staff of the Chinese military put Mr. Ewell Brown in a jet that goes to Inner Mongolia. About 3 hours later, Mr. Ewell Brown is shown a laboratory where there's about 40, 50 people, and say, here are your colleagues. And within a week, Mr. Ewell Brown produces a very new design for the Chinese, for Brown's gas generator, of a machine that can be bought in those days, this is before the economic boom of China, that even a poor Chinese tradesman, you know, like a bicycle repairman, could afford with 3 months' pay. So, and of course, using no cost for acetylene and so on as a welding device, and very low consumption of electricity.
So are we to assume that even
no,
if
we but you see what happens here? I mean, that the equivalent of a chief executive officer in China is able to make results happen immediately, you know, like with minutes count. Whereas in the United States, we could even wait several decades and still nothing will be done for Yul Brown, even if hundreds of CEOs and large corporations have had a chance to see it in a very leisurely pace, you know, comfortable, sitting in a nice boardroom, et cetera, et cetera. And that shows there's something wrong in the way that our Western civilization administers itself vis-a-vis innovation.
Yeah. Well, you know, this Western civilization is one of instant gratification. So in many ways, we do react quickly, and they do bring things to market quickly, but not the important things, the trivial things, things dealing with entertainment and the latest gadgets for our kids to play with, high-tech gadgets.
Well, even those were created actually in Japan.
Sure.
They have not been created in the United States or Canada or Europe, with the exception being Philips in Holland probably maybe some German companies who eventually gave patents to the licensing fees to Japanese corporations. But even then, you see, this is still very unusual. It was not designed. I mean, it may have been designed in part in the United States. Some technology may have even been lifted off, say, military. You know, exempted military technology. Like, for example, a very good example of that is the dolls that talk, you know, that was a very secret technology that was developed by DARPA, Department of the United States Air Force, that ended up allowing dolls to talk.
Amazing. I didn't realize it was...
Yeah, I was so surprised. As a matter of fact,
it went from a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, the talking dolls of the 80s. That was a shock because DARPA never expected this to be ever made to the public, and by some fluke, you know, some bureaucratic fluke, Mattel. I don't know which company had it first. Got this chip, you know, that was coming straight from the most advanced aircraft the military had in the United States. It was only supposed to be used by maybe 100 pilots at the most. You know.
Let me back up just a minute. From your earlier comment about how inexpensive a Brown's gas welding unit was made available to the Chinese,
yes,
of all the products they're manufacturing and shipping over here to the West, are these things being manufactured with Brown's gas?
Oh, yes, very much so. There are lots of things. Like, for example, all ships since around 1985 onwards built in China, built Brown's gas, they have desalination units which allow more containers to be used, so they make the water that the ships require is made as a ship goes, you know. There are lots of facilities like hospitals and so on in China use Brown's gas waste incinerators.
Really?
Yes, and a factory that used to make locomotives, and of course, locomotives in China is a big deal because you know railways are still the main working horse of China. The factories to make this is the factory where the Joint Chief of Staff took Yul Brown, produces Brown's gas generators since 85 or something like that on a three ship basis, 24 hours a day. So I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of generators have been built in China already. The only reason why you don't see them exported is because the agreement with Yul Brown was that the Chinese were not allowed to export brown gas generators. They were only allowed to, in the beginning, that's even before Hong Kong became, you know, a part of China, they were allowed to be sold to Hong Kong. That was about it.
Yeah. But you would say then, I would gather from your comments, that the West is really at a great disadvantage in the way that we have been dumbed down and not allowed to benefit from advanced technologies.
Well, yes, that's true. But it's not so much advanced technology, but it is the innovations that can occur. Now, brown gas is actually a very simple technology. It's a technology that could have been even invented and made in the 1700s. You know, like electrolysis is not a new invention. It's just that by chance, here's a guy who actually dared to put hydrogen and oxygen together and nothing happened. I mean, that was bad. Only good things happen, okay? And then you spend 10 years watching to a glass or plexiglass generators, what happened inside the generator. So he was able to make them better and better and better. Now, it's only in the last 6 or 7 years that there's now a new generation of brown gas generators that could be made. This was a second thought that Yul Brynner had. You know, this what I'm doing now is all old-fashioned stuff, you know, like even Chinese can build these things, you know. But there are now new types of brown gas generators that are very small, that produce much more gas, you know, per watt, and are used very high-tech materials. And they have very stringent requirements.
High-tech materials meaning the...
And they're made in Korea. They're made in Korea, and they are second generation. Well, this is new technology. This is high-tech advanced technology.
Are you referring to the anode and cathode materials when you say high-tech materials?
Yes, they're different materials, different processes, different way of looking at electrolysis, too, you know. So it's and what they will allow to is the possibility, which you about love as you know, like where people want to make money out of this, was that you could put brown gas into hybrid materials like little bricks, you know, something the size of normal brick, and which would be enough brown gas to run, say, electricity in the home. Electricity fuel, like, you know, for ovens and so on, say for a month. So you'd rent a brick that will be full of brown gas with enough energy there for anything the whole house would need, you know, cooking, ventilation, air conditioning, and everything, you know, condensed in one brick. And this was, that would be high tech. So you'd rent something like for, say, $25, and you'll have everything you need, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So it's a medium of storage.
Yeah, and that's right. And this is something that he was working on. That would have been high-tech. You know, this, because in this case, it's the most advanced knowledge of the day would make that possible.
Yeah. Of course, hydrogen on demand doesn't.
Well, it wouldn't be hydrogen, it would be brown gas, like a mixture of oxygen, hydrogen, and the soup, you know.
Right. Now, let's go on then. Mr. Bird, then, Christopher Bird, was responsible for introducing Yul Brynner's technology to the...
So I had to be shown to the Western world, you know, because Christopher Bird was able to see the implications of brown gas. Like, you know, it would have transformed America way back in the early 80s.
And yet it didn't.
It didn't.
Okay.
And every chief executive officer who could have done anything about it was shown. Like, no stone was left unturned.
Yeah.
Now, what it did lead to was an agreement with a Canadian industrialist who decided to use foundation money, like not-for-profit money, to see how far could brown gas be, you know, advanced into more modern aspects. So Yul Brynner came a second time to North America, and this time he ended up being in a wonderful retreat in the Rockies in Colorado. And then nothing happened. You know, he was promised $17 million. You have all the time you need, you know, do whatever you have to do. We'll take care of you. You'll be able to eat, sleep, and, you know, and so on, in peace. then the money never came.
And again, this in contrast to his experience in China.
Jeez. Well, who knows why? I mean, I've never been able to unravel that story. But
well, let's move on. Yeah. I think we've covered Yul Brynner's work pretty good, and we've seen that he was underappreciated, and his technology has been utilized in some places but not others.
No. And, of course, among the things that Christopher Bird did was try to see whether we could make certain applications, for example, that you never thought of. Like, one was to see whether for the military one could make hardened chips for computer chips. You know, like even during a nuclear warfare, the computers would still run. Because one characteristic of Brown's gas, by the way, is you can harden concrete, which would have been wonderful for earthquake zones, say, of California, that the sewer pipes and water pipes will not burst, you know, even in major earthquakes. But also to make chips that will be hardened. The interesting thing there, you know, there we have people like Texas Instruments and so on getting involved and so on, and other people who supply companies like that. And the amazing thing was when I observed this, because in this case I was able to actually participate in the process of trying to get, you know, high-tech companies to use for specific applications of Brown's gas, was that there was less interest in making the product than to see what tax advantage you could make out of it.
Hmm.
You know, like so there will be some government system whereby, even though if you try to do R&D, they'll give you some money, etc. But the focus seemed to have been, let's see how much we can get out of government, you know, for trying this, rather than to actually make the product.
Amazing.
You know, and that's very, very corporate welfare mentality.
Well, the thing about it is that there's no consideration for the for the planet, for the atmosphere, for the pollution that we're emitting constantly.
Yeah.
Instead, and I've often noticed this, the word sustainability, when used by these people, has nothing to do with the sustainability of life on this planet. It has to do with sustainability of their income streams and their profits.
Oh, whatever, yes. But so people don't seem to have the ability to say, well, you know, we're lucky to have a creative mind, a good technology. Let's see what is going to do good for our company, you know, or for our business and so on. There's always something lurking behind, well, maybe I can get some other advantage that's more interesting than do something good for my company, or for whatever, you know.
Well, there's nothing wrong with looking at the bottom line, but why couldn't they see that?
Well, the Chinese certainly are looking at the bottom line, and they're making good money out of Brown's gas, I believe me. You know. But anyway, so this is I've seen with Yul Brynner lots of aspects of our society that we just don't know how to cope.
And you're saying that these apply to other inventors and their inventions as well?
Probably, yes.
This is an example.
See, Yul Brynner was a little lucky because, on the one hand, to get the factory started in Australia, he got, you know, through our network, a dean of a very credible university in Australia saying, this is good, you know.
And that would be Mr. Bockris.
That would be Bockris. Then he gets the support of somebody, what we can say, from American aristocracy, for all intents and purposes, who's saying, you know, like a Medici type of guy, who's saying, listen, this is good stuff for America, you know, and is telling this to his friends in the corporate world. I'm showing you something really on a golden platter. Now, And that includes NASA, of all things. You know what happened to NASA? Yul Brynner went to Cape Canaveral with his best generator, and he was at, because he was very well introduced, there were seven scientists sitting on a table opposite him, you know, in a major room. Unfortunately, Yul Brynner had an attitude. He always liked to smoke. So he before putting on the generator, he lights a cigarette, and he starts, while he's talking, remember, this is a Bulgarian, you know, he starts moving a cigarette and smoke wafting all over the place, and he says, "I'm now going to show you that you can mix hydrogen and oxygen together." Now, before he could even switch on the table, the chief in the table, you know, said, called the military police and said, "Get this guy out of here. We don't want Cape Canaveral to blow up."
Isn't that funny?
Okay. So now, had they listened.
And that was the end of it?
That's the end of it.
You
he was escorted
it.
Out of it. No. So you can imagine. And of course, when something similar happened in Beijing University, everyone hid behind the best furniture, because the Yul Brynner did the same thing, moving his cigarette up and, you know, like waving, gesticulating, you know, all over the place. And say,
but he knew about the combustibility of the gases, so he wasn't worried.
Everyone ran behind, you know, the thick oak furniture because they thought the whole aula would explode, you know.
That's
but
hilarious.
Anyway, especially on the size of the generator. We're talking about generators that were capable of producing 8,000 liters per hour, you know, of gas. You know?
Wow.
So there will be something like 6 to 7 feet high by 4 by 4 feet. You know, I mean, we're talking about huge things. They will probably contain some like 16 large cylinders, you know, the highest you can think of that you see in trucks when they deliver, you know, gases.
I may have taken cover, too. We've used about half of our time.
But see, if they had not done that, we would have now had rockets that would have been doing, you know, much more powerful, much more energetic than anything America had ever used, for less energy, you know, I mean, less gas, you know, than they use. Much safer, you know, no danger of explosion or like that. Lighter, of course, so therefore they could, you know, use less fuel even to leave the atmosphere. And America would be having many, and of course, launches that would not destroy the atmosphere. This is another thing. People don't realize that much of the climate change we have to date is because we're destroying the atmosphere all over the place, you know. And thanks to also these, you know, high flying things, all which are not helpful.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, we would have had planes that could fly, lightweight planes that could fly, say, on a gallon of water, maybe for 100,000 feet or 200,000 feet, say for a month. You know, little lightweight planes that would run on brown gas. You know. We would have it, like, that would be our weather satellite instead of having to send rockets and so on. So it would have been a totally different picture if people had not been so scared of his flinging cigarettes. And all.
Well, apparently it's not too late for this technology to make a recurrence.
No, it's not too late.
It is now. Even now it's happening, isn't it?
Well, in China, yes, and in Korea as well, too. So it's happening there, yeah.
Well, and I think that us doing this program right now is also making people more aware of the fact that a superior technology has been shunned by certain individuals in our society.
Yeah, thanks to Yul Brynner's effort and the fact that Chinese have followed through. Like, China now has 4,000 postgraduate students who are in specialists in brown gas in various sectors and various disciplines, okay? And so... We have now a technology that has become mature. You know, like we may have a situation where the reverse of what's been going on the last few years, that, you know, the China's economy has gone very well, thanks to the fact that they went from the Middle Ages to, you know, the best that the West is capable of doing in a few years' time. Well, now they may be able to give us a good bronze gas technology that could help our world make a quantum leap ahead, too.
Absolutely. Well, that's what it's about, really. It's about a two-way communication.
I hope so.
Yeah, and there's a great deal that the West has shared with them, as you said, and now maybe they can help to reintroduce, really, because even Yul Brynn's work, so many of these things go back to what already happened in the U.S. a century ago. You know, he referenced William Rhodes' patent in his...
Well, yes, device. Because the it's not so much Rhodes did not actually. There are certain things that are similar, but not. You know, I've actually tried to figure out from all I could get from Rhodes what were the characteristics. Like Rhodes never got a gas that had the characteristics which are very critical in this case, and that is the ability to have enough ion content in it that it actually allows boiling point achievement on contact with a flame. That was never something that Rhodes was able to do.
Now, do you know how that ion metamorphosis or whatever is carried out? Do you know what caused it?
It's a simple fact that you're containing it in the, like while you're doing electrolysis, you're keeping everything that's been electrolyzed in the box, so to speak. Inside the electrolyzer.
It doesn't have to do with
until you need it.
EMF or something.
Beg your pardon?
It doesn't have to do with introducing EMF to the gas.
That's not necessary. Now, if you wanted to change characteristics of bronze gas and tailor it, like, you know, who knows what it is. It might be like, say, these were 3% of this kind of helium, and I'm sorry, of this kind of hydrogen, and at least 5% of that kind of oxygen. Well, then you can try electronics, you know. And of course, this is where another scientist by the name of Andrea Puharich made some progress.
Okay, why don't we talk about him now? Perhaps you could just tell us, when did you first come in contact with Dr. Puharich?
Well, Puharich was one of the first people to pop up in the around 1973-74. In meetings with Senator Carter, the founder of our association in Ottawa, where we were trying to see what could be done about Canada's, you know, scientific and technical future, and looking at Tesla's work. Now, Puharich got involved with Nikola Tesla by the sheer fact that for a period of time he was the medical doctor of the Joint Chief of Staff of the United States. He said, I have the smallest group of patients, 5. and I only have to worry about them.
Puharich was a medical doctor?
For the Joint Chief of Staff.
Really?
And he was a damn good one, too.
Because he was an Army doctor, wasn't he?
Well, he was a PhD in physics at the same time a medical doctor.
What a combination.
Now, at a certain moment, when the issue came up that, by legally, the United States had to give to a heir of Nikola Tesla, the Kosanovich, in a communist country, all the goods of Nikola Tesla,
because
all the belongings.
Because they were creating a museum for him.
Yeah. And in the meantime, about 40 different agencies in the United States had received photocopies of all the papers that had never been published. Well, Puharich was asked, since he was a Yugoslav of origin, you know, born from a Yugoslav family in Chicago, why don't you look at this, you know? And in this stuff that was never published was something that Nikola Tesla called a resonant electricity. And this was the way by which later Andrea Puharich, when he left that position, was able to make the first hearing aids and actually became financially independent. You know, the small hearing aids we see all over the place, everyone's wearing them, you know, going to death.
And Puarich was directly responsible for the creation of that.
Yes, and he got it from that work. You know, this was, okay, Monique.
So, hello?
I'm sorry.
So this is an example similar to the talking doll.
This is radio, okay? Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry, yes?
This is an example similar to the talking doll, then.
Yes. And Puarich was able to, he also thought about whether this would have the ability to disassociate certain chemical and certain compounds and molecules. And he wondered whether it would be possible to do electrolysis with this phenomenon that Nikola Tesla called, and never published anywhere else, you know, called electrical resonance, which Andrea later called phonon effect. Now, this is where you mix sound waves and electronics. Okay? And so it is a very, it has two aspects to it. One is that you have great control, you know, even into millisecond aspects of any waveform on the one hand, and you have great control on power that you are putting into any particular, you know, stream process, you know. And he wondered whether it was possible to dissociate water, you know, to have water as a fuel in this process. Now, he developed a system, you know, like at a certain moment, Andrea was no longer financially independent. Like, he had the house, he had the lab, which, you know, which he got from his financial independence. He had to still depend on some philanthropy, which, by the way, came from the Reynolds family, the tobacco family, one of the black sheep in the family. that's Josh Reynolds III, who offered him eventually a lab, because his first lab was burned down by some government agents, you know. But anyway, so you got a lab. And you had to use something simple. So what do you use as for electrolysis? And yet to be able to have all the ability to produce the special waveforms and whatnot, was to use the old-fashioned pre-World War II or during World War II Champern spark plugs. And you would work around them as a... to have an anode and cathode.
Oh, so that's what his patent drawing is actually showing. Is
yeah,
it blown
the, yeah, he would scour the hills, hillbilly gas stations off North Carolina, Tennessee, to see, have you got any old-fashioned, you know, Champern spark plugs? You know?
Really? See, it looks like a spark plug, but
that's
I thought
right.
Surely it can't be, but it is.
Yes, it is.
Amazing. See, I assumed that it was a much larger size chamber.
No. That's what it was.
And yet, he wasn't using the spark plug to inject the fuel in an engine. He was simply using the spark plug as his chamber.
Yes, that's right.
It had nothing to do with injecting the fuel.
Well, you could still, not injecting the fuel, but you could still wind around it and so on. You know?
But other people have come out with injector plugs. This was nothing like that. This was just an electrolysis chamber that was an old
spark
plug.
That's right. And the beauty of this system, of course, is that as you drive, as you push the pedal, you get the gas you need.
In other words, it was an on-demand system.
That's right. So, which put him into several predicaments, because eventually he solved all the problems. There were lots of problems with it. One of the problems was that... contrary to Brown's gas, where the problem can be bubbles, and then you don't know what to do, or you have a foaming and things start arcing, sparking, and so on, and the old generator can become very hot until you solve the problem, which are, you know, engineers should solve them. Well, in his case, Andrea's problems were algae. And he actually began, being a doctor, he began to realize that the more he was using the system, the more life forms were created, some you've never seen before.
Really?
Yes. First, there were all kinds of amino acids. They was producing, you know, just straight from water. All he had water, distilled water. Even from distilled water, he would have amino acids produced.
Now, you're talking about the gunk that appears in an electrolyzer.
Yeah, but this is not just algae. This was, he began to actually analyze. As a matter of fact, at a certain moment, Andrea became, like he was so amazed by this, that he became an expert on RNA and DNA. He was started to know all the highest scientists in the world. I mean, even in Western Europe, you know, going to the best academies. This
because
was,
of the analyzing the gunk.
Just trying to figure out everything he could about DNA and stuff. Because, see, I'm producing this stuff, you know, coming out of water. But anyway, so this is...
it wasn't a residue coming from the plates.
No, there was no plate.
Because people...
It's
jabbing
spark plug, you know. Okay, so anyway, and this would evolve. These things would evolve. But anyway, he solved that problem too. Like there was no more life. You know, he actually started putting some alkalines and so on. And all. But eventually he got. This was a gift from the Reynolds family. The biggest possible mobile home you could buy in the United States.
A motor home.
Yeah, but I mean really huge one, like two bedrooms and all, two bathrooms and so on. And he never needed to fill up the tank. All he was putting was water. And of course, because you know you can go 1,000 miles from 1 gallon of water. I mean heavens, you know, you know 5 gallons, you're already crossing America, you know. So, even to the mountains and whatnot. So he was used to the fact that his mileage would show empty. You know, like because there's still 3 or 4 gallons when it's empty in the tank, and he would forget sometime because he was always researching and thinking about other things and giving speeches and so on. That he was sometimes driving literally an empty tank. And he got lost twice in a very embarrassing situations with this. One, he was in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, which is one of the driest deserts in the world. And there it is, the motorhome stops. No, you know, empty, really was empty. And you look and look and you look, and finally after walking for, you know, 15, 20 minutes, he noticed there was still some salt water pan. And he said, God, you know, if I put this out, curl my entire engine and so on. Anyway, he put it, and he was able to keep on going, and that solved that problem. So he was able to go another, you know, a few hundred miles toward Mexico City. Now, the next time it happened, he was still in Mexico, and now he was in the mountains, you know, like 6,000 or 7,000 feet in the mountains. And fortunately, there was snow, so he just jam-packed his tank with snow and said, God, I hope this thing melts, you know. with that, he was able to have enough power to, you know, to get to go down the hill or up the hill, whatever, to get some ordinary water.
What an interesting story. Did any other vehicles ever get converted to his system?
No. This
just
was something he was still researching. He was preparing himself for patents. He was not allowed to talk too much about it. I was one of the very few people privy to this, and of course I had to keep my mouth shut and so on. What he did do, however, when he came to Canada, you know, with his huge motor car, several times he came back and forth from Mexico. He went at least 300,000 miles with his motorhome with water as a fuel. was that... I made a video, a quality video of a presentation at our Learning Society meeting in the National Library of Canada, where he tried to protect himself in case the U.S. military would take the technology away, which they could, you know, by secrecy, that at least there would be a record of it, the full disclosure. Of it, and this video we still have, you know.
And that's available from PACE.
Yes.
Yes, and we can mention again that's the website from which these.
And it's a black and white video, of course. Like this is the old-fashioned 3/4-inch video, but which of course converted DVDs and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is available from the, the website of, what's it again, PACE?
PACE, like HTTP, pacenet.homestead.com. That's PACENET.homestead.com.
And there, the video of Andrea Jabbour
will be called Energy from Water.
Mm-hmm. As well as other materials.
Yeah, and this video also explains one aspect which he did check with an outside independent laboratory, that there was actually a minimum energy efficiency of 112%. So this meant that as the water was being used and the battery charges it up, you know, with this Champion spark plug and so on, eventually you're charging up the battery too. Not only are you driving the thing, you know. So the water is actually is a real fuel that ends up charging the battery, you know, as you keep on going.
Right. Now, so you were in contact with Mr. Pruarich for many years.
Yes. I'm not sure, probably at least 10 or more years.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was responsible for other awesome research, wasn't he?
Yes, at that time, quite a few interesting things, yes.
But the water fuel aspect was one that...
well, it's an interesting one, but it was not very well known. He was a little leery of making it too well known, really. But he did, you know, at least it allowed him to travel with his family across, you know, both from Canada to Mexico, back and forth many times.
Well, and his U.S. patent is quite revealing as far as the theory of overcoming the bonds of the water molecule.
Yes.
Now, what other water fuel device inventors have you come to know then? We've mentioned Brown and Pruarich. Were you in contact with Stan Meyer?
Well, Stan Myers, my experience with Stan Myers is limited. First, I never really met the person. But, I mean, I did see him across in a hall or that kind of thing, but I never met the person on a one-to-one basis. So I cannot comment on that aspect. He was, to my understanding, a person who sort of avoided others in some under certain circumstances. Now, so there was never any opening to us. However, there was an opening to one aspect of our network, and that was to our Swiss colleagues. So we have a chapter in Switzerland called SAFE, that's the Swiss Association for Free Energy. And they invited Stan Myers to come to Switzerland for a conference. And the understanding was that he would come along with his generator, basically, and make a demonstration. He did come along without any demonstration. Now, one of the things the SAFE people did is that they had put aside quite a bit of money for an analysis of the Stan Meyer technology. And there was a very good friend of mine, a physicist from Bulgaria, Stefan Marinov, who was assigned this work to look, you know, as much as was required for his time, get calmly to interview Mr. Meyer and so on. And I shared the room for the conference, which lasted quite some time in Switzerland. And at the end of this effort, Mr. Marinov told me, you know, Andrew, this is the first time it's happened to me, but I still can't understand and be sure what the hell is Mr. Stanmeyer talking about. Like, you know, anyone actually showed me, you know, to hear such and such rationale, and it's not, it makes sense, and so on, but still, he look at this, it doesn't follow, and of course, I have nothing to look at, and so I have nothing to, you know, to measure, so I cannot make any comments. So this was left in my mind, because I know Mr. Marinov was a very thorough person. He had certainly received a very handsome budget for this, you know, like he was very happy to have proper time, you know, funds to do this properly. And he comes saying to me, you know, I cannot say either way. And that left me and several of my colleagues with the same feeling. We just cannot make a pronouncement on Stan Meyer's technology.
I think Eugene Maloff made a similar comment.
Okay.
Based on contacts he had with him at different energy companies.
So, I mean, we have to leave open, like you can't say no and you can't say yes. You know.
What about the company Exogen, a Canadian company that replicated...
I have nothing, I even know less. Because, I mean, at least Stan Meyer gave you patents, he gave figures and even photographs of things and so on, but a diagram from these people is nothing. So I cannot, that's
actually,
even worse.
Actually, Exogen does have a patent.
Beg your pardon?
They have at least one U.S. patent.
Oh, I was not aware of that, no. I'm only basing on what I knew, what, but 2 years ago, I believe, on that, no. So, again, then maybe you know more. Maybe you can brief me on that.
Actually, I am not at liberty to discuss
okay.
Exogen's current situation, but there is reason to believe that there may be some technology forthcoming from them still.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you something while you mentioned Switzerland. There is supposedly a colony, a religious colony in Switzerland that had some over-unity energy.
Oh, that's what Marinov was able to check, that the Testatica actually worked, and he even was able to find out how it worked. Like, you know, he was able to analyze every aspect of the circuit and so on. And he said, you know, I have kept my word. I'm not going to say how it worked, but I know it works, and I know why it works. So, and he made it very clear to me that was not just Windhurst's phenomenon. You know, some people say, oh, this is just static electricity, et cetera.
For those who are not aware of what we're talking about, why don't you just briefly recap what it is?
Maybe you can do it better than me.
In other words, this is a religious...
Well, it's a commune. It's people who have, what can I say, are convinced that they have been in contact with extraterrestrials who would have given them one way or another information that on how to be totally energy independent as a commune, if you wish, which they are.
They've been there now for, what, 20, 30 years? Or?
Let's put it around 20 years. You know, maybe it could be more.
And so what they have is some kind of device that generates electricity.
Enough for their homes and cooking and everything they need for the commune, yes.
Uh-huh. But they have not shared it with the outside world.
And as far as I can describe it to you, it looks like a mini closet, you know, like it's something that will be, say, 6 or 7 feet high, or maybe 6 inches deep, you know, 4 or 5 feet wide, and it has what look like static electric wheels, you know, that can turn in opposite directions. But that supposedly produces the power that people are using in Switzerland, you know, 50 hertz.
Your friend analyzed their...
Oh, yes, he was able, he got the trust of these people. This is one thing nice about Marinov. He was able to, people knew that he was a really good physicist. I mean, really, very, very high quality, maybe one of the top 100 in the world. And yet very, very open-minded and very friendly, you know, like to talk to ordinary guys and, you know. and girls and so on. So they felt that, and they felt comfortable with him, and they actually said, okay, we'll show you how it works, and all, which is very unusual because that group is, for all intents and purposes, to most of us, would look like the most paranoid group you can think of, you know. But they felt very comfortable. And he stayed with them the time it took, several weeks, and he was very pleased. You know, he said, this really worked.
Now, from what I understand, I've not done any extensive reading about them, and this is all through hearsay, but from what I've heard, the reason they give for not sharing their technology with the outside world is that they don't feel that we are ready for it or that we
this is the storyline that they put, and they've always insisted on that. That's true.
Now, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that mankind in general is...
Well, mankind has always been ready for almost everything. We certainly seem to be ready to be poisoned by lots of bad pesticides, and we're ready to be given genetically modified foods and trans fats and so on. So I'm sure we're ready for clean energy. I mean, heavens, it's not worse than the other stuff, you know. So,
but in other words, there seems to be a lot of propaganda dispensed from all angles saying that free energy would destroy the economy of the world. Free energy.
No. The German government, a German university in Hagen, that's a technical university, with an econometrist, did a study with the view that this would be passed on to the German government, and actually was passed on to European Parliament, too.
When was this?
This would be the late 90s.
Really?
A study, what would happen if free energy or even water as a fuel became part of the German economy? Now, first of all, let's look at Germany. Germany is a country that is energy not dependent. It's not independent. They have to import everything. Now, it is also a very advanced economy and a very dense country. Very, very dense. You know, it's like if all of the United States were looked like Boston to Washington, you know, basically, with very few places where there's some greenery and so on. Now, so this is Germany, and they say, well, you know, let's look at cars. If cars ran on brown gas, you cannot change. It's just physically impossible, all cars into water as a fuel, even though you don't have to change engines. You know, like you don't have to change. You just have to tune the carburetor. That's all you have to do, you know. There's no change in there. Even people are used to having their Mercedes-Benz run this way and their Auto Union this way and their, you know, Volkswagen that way. They're not going to be jumping to drive with water. So they say it would take 10 years, and if we say a tenth of the car, 10% of the cars increase, you know, like 10, 20, 30% car, would be converted to water. And, of course, in the meantime, you're closing down the gas station, but you're not closing down the mechanical, the mechanics in the garage. The cars still have to be fixed. So, in that sense, almost nothing would change as far as the economy associated with distribution of gasoline.
And it would be a gradual change, in other words.
Like, you wouldn't see that suddenly there's no more gas station, you know. Well, there still will be gas station because there's still a garage, or at least in the German sense, okay? Now, the second thing that would happen is that this would give a huge impact on the importation. Like, in the case of Germany, they wouldn't have to import. And that's a huge boost for the German economy. A huge boost for the money. This is before the euro became the currency. So the German currency would have gone really upwards. You know, they'll be importing less and exporting more. Now, the other aspect, which was the most exciting one, was that in reality, having fossil fuels is actually ruining the German economy from a point of view of environmentally. It's cost a lot of money, unbelievably high amount of money, that there are fossil fuels.
By the way, we are in our last minute now.
No, but here's how. The air quality, buildings are being destroyed, decaying faster. You know, like every building.
Yeah. There are many negative effects, aren't
there? Yeah. Even roads corrode faster.
Right.
You know, they actually put a number on this. And the simple fact that people will be running on water would make it cheaper for the federal government of Germany
to maintain
roads.
Amazing.
Maintenance of buildings, which is very, very expensive. You know,
Mr. McCroskey, we're down to our last few seconds.
Okay.
I hate to say it, but we've run out of time. But there's plenty more for us to talk about, and perhaps we can take this up on another occasion still again.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining
us. You're welcome.
Take care.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us. I hope to have you and our listening audience again next time. Thank you.